This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Lessons, My Path to a Meaningful Life by Giselle Bündchen. Read for you by Sunila Nankani, with an introduction read by the author.
This book is dedicated to Vivi, Benny, and Jack. Thank you for your love, for being the light of my life, for being the most incredible teachers, and allowing me to travel on new roads, discovering deeper meanings and purpose. You are my inspiration every day to do all I can to make the world a better place. Amuva Sis. Introduction. If my intention was to write a straightforward chronicle of my life so far, the fast-cut version might go like this. My name is Gisele Caroline Bündchen. I've worked as a fashion model for the past 23 years. I was born in 1980 and grew up in Horizontina, a small town in southern Brazil, an hour from where you cross the river to enter Argentina. I'm fifth-generation Brazilian of German descent on both sides. My parents spoke German with each other and Portuguese to my five sisters and me. I'm a middle child. And as kids, my twin sister Pachi and I used to argue about which one of us was the third or the fourth in age. When I was growing up, I wanted to be either a professional volleyball player or a veterinarian. When I was 13 years old, my mom, who worried about my bad posture, I was already 5 feet 9 inches tall, enrolled two of my sisters and me in a local modeling course. At the end of the course, we got to go on a special trip to Curitiba, São Paulo, and Rio de Janeiro. The bus ride there felt endless, 27 hours long. Some of the mothers came with us, including mine. At a São Paulo mall, a man came up to me with a classic creepy guy line. "Do you want to be a model?" "Mom!" I yelled, and over she ran. But he, Zeca was his name, was for real, a scout for the elite model management. When we went to his office, he told my mom she should enroll me in a national contest, Elite Look of the Year, and so she did. I couldn't believe it when I won second place, which came with a round-trip plane ticket to Ibiza, Spain, so I could model in the Elite Model Look World Contest. It was my first time on a plane, my first trip outside Brazil. Somehow, I ended up as one of the 10 finalists. Everything was happening so fast. A year later, in 1995, I moved to São Paulo to launch my modeling career. I was 14. As you can imagine, moving from a small town of only 17,000 people to the largest city in Brazil was a big change. After I spent a few months working in São Paulo, the agency sent me to Tokyo, Japan, where I lived for 3 months doing catalog work. My first big break came a few years later in London, when the designer Alexander McQueen selected me to model in his ready-to-wear show. I went down the runway without a shirt, petrified, a white top painted on, at the last minute by a makeup artist, as artificial rain poured down from the ceiling. After the Alexander McQueen show, the industry gave me a nickname, The Body, which stuck. In 1999, I modeled for Versace, Ralph Lauren, Chloe, Missoni, Valentino, Armani, and Dolce & Gabbana. Vogue magazine chose me to represent the end of the heroin chic era of modeling. That year, I was on the cover of French Vogue and 3 times on the cover of American Vogue. The headline on one feature story was "The Return of the Curve." I ended that year winning Vogue's Model of the Year award. In spring 2000, I modeled for Marc Jacobs, Donna Karan, Calvin Klein, Christian Dior, Prada, Valentino, and many other well-known brands in New York, Milan, and Paris. From 1998 to 2003, I appeared in every one of Dolce & Gabbana's fashion campaigns. And from 2000 to 2007, I was one of the Victoria's Secret angels. In the past 20 years, I've appeared on 1,200 magazine covers, 450 fashion editorials, and walked nearly 500 fashion shows. I deliberately took a step back from modeling in 2015, as I wanted to focus more on my family and personal projects. The last time I walked on a runway was during the opening of the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio. I came down the longest runway I've ever been on, while a pianist played Tom Jobim's The Girl from Ipanema. It was electrifying. It felt like the culmination of everything that had gone before. All of that happened, though I left out all the details. It's the story of the public me, but the life I've lived in public has very little connection to who I really am, or what matters most to me, or what I believe in and want to give back to the world. The irony is that, though I'm known for my work as a model, I never felt that the person on the runway or in magazines and TV commercials was me. In school in Brazil, I'd been mocked by my classmates for my height and my weight and my appearance. I don't believe any level of success as an adult completely changes how you saw yourself as a child. So when I began modeling, even though I supposedly had a model's physique, I felt awkward. It didn't help my confidence when some people in the business told me that my eyes were too small and my nose and boobs were too big. At age 14, nothing felt more unsettling or made me feel more self-conscious than a designer telling me I was pretty or a photographer telling me how to stand, or an editor commenting on my body or my breast or my eyes or my nose as if I weren't even in the room. That's why, starting around the age of 18, in an effort to protect myself and to avoid getting hurt or feeling objectified, I created a shield around myself. The private me was Gisele, but the model Giselle was her. That's what I called her too, her. She was an actress, a performer, a chameleon, a made-up character expressing the fantasy of a designer. I showed up at the job. I learned what the photographer wanted, what the stylist wanted, what the makeup artist wanted. Their ideas came together to create a mood, and suddenly I could see her. Modeling was a way for me to explore all the colors of my personality, including ones I didn't know I had. As she, or her, I could act out any emotion, any attitude. It was as if, by detaching myself, I could be free, while keeping the real me hidden and safe. She could be sexy or demure. She could be a soldier or a brazen woman. She could be a face or a body somewhere in between. Modeling had never been my dream. Growing up, I didn't even know it was an actual profession. I simply saw what was happening to me as an opportunity to make a living. Doors opened, first one, then another, and I walked through them. There was a practical component to it as well. As a child, I had heard my parents arguing about money. I thought if I tried out modeling, and maybe even got good at it, I might be able to help our family. So I decided to take the opportunity I was being offered and see what might become of it. But instead of writing about her, I want to focus on who I am. So in this book, I've laid out the lessons that have helped me live a more conscious and joyful life, inspired me to overcome challenges I faced over the years, including panic attacks, and giving me a deeper understanding of myself and the world around me. Some of these lessons I've learned the hard way, through personal experience. Others I learned through watching others over the years, and concluding what not to do and how not to act. Each of the chapters in this book has stories taken from my own experiences, illustrating my learning process and what was happening in my life at the time. I've had many teachers along the way too. I've discovered that nature is the most powerful teacher and healer. I've learned to pay attention to my inner voice, which has given me many important insights, even when I didn't want to listen. I've learned that our thoughts, words, and actions are all connected, and why we need to be careful with them. I began nourishing my body, mind, and spirit through meditation, healing foods, and a positive outlook. And as a result, was able to experience a deeper clarity and greater sense of purpose. I hope that sharing my own story can serve as an inspiration to others and be of help. So if the model I talked about earlier was her, who am I? If there's one word I use to describe myself, it's simple. I'm a barefoot jeans and t-shirt kind of girl. My family would tell you the same. I've always been a student of life, always curious, always wanting to know more. Naturally, when I left my hometown to begin modeling, I started to experience the world in new ways. Over the next 2 decades, I began the process of discovering who I was. As I said, that Gisele is very different from my public self. I was born into a hard-working, middle-class family in a city in the southern Brazil called Três de Maio. Along with my parents, there were 6 of us girls. Haki, Fofa, Pati, Gizi, that's me, Gabi, and Fafi. My mom worked as a teller at a local bank. My dad was an entrepreneur who worked in real estate as a sales representative. He had so many different jobs. Forever reading, learning, and creating, he was and still is a genuine free spirit. Today, he's a motivational speaker and sociologist who works with me on environmental projects. We were lucky to have many varieties of fruit trees in our backyard. Avocados, pitanga, which is a kind of red cherry, peach, guava, papaya, bucha, or jelly palm, and 3 different kinds of tangerines, my favorite fruit, which I will fold into the front of my t-shirt and lug home. I always loved nature. I felt that the dirt or sand under my feet and the trees and the clouds and the birds and the sunlight were a part of who I was, that I was nature. I remember how much I loved visiting my grandmother's farm, where she milked cows, grew most of what she ate, and sew her own clothes. She would cook us delicious foods such as kuka, a German version of panettone, but with tiny chunks of strawberries or grapes baked into it, which she served with fresh heavy cream, still warm from the milk bucket. I grew up Roman Catholic, and my mom made us go to church every Sunday. Like my sisters, I wasn't all that happy sitting on a hard bench, listening to the priest talking. But I did love the singing. My mom had a loud, beautiful soprano voice. And afterward, eating whatever dishes the church lady set out. Cabbage salad, pasta, and churrasco, a way of grilling meat and chicken on a stick, with the other kids. I still love the stories in the Bible, and I teach them to my own children. But I was always digging and digging to find out the why of everything. And at some point, I began questioning what I was being taught. One day in religion class, when I was 12 or 13 years old, we were studying Leviticus. I raised my hand. How could the mandate, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, exist side by side with Jesus teaching us we should love our enemies and always turn the other cheek? How did that work? I wasn't trying to be smart, but it made no sense. Instead of answering the question or starting a discussion, the teacher looked surprised and then frustrated and sent me to the principal. I didn't think I'd done anything wrong. I still don't. Why couldn't she give me an answer? If she couldn't, who would? Not my parents. My mom and dad were too busy running around working while trying to raise 6 girls. And the questions I wanted answers to were accumulating. Who was I? Why was I here? How did the world begin? As the questions increased, so did my resistance against any kind of system that said, these are the facts, this is how it works, and there is only one way. Maybe it was my constant searching that led me to be fascinated by the world of spirit. I'd pray at night to God, to my star, to my guardian angels. In my early teens, I began reading not just about religion, but belief and metaphysics and mythology. Those are still my favorite subjects, At some point, I begin believing that all of us live in a world ruled by illusions, and that our job, is to find out who we truly are and discover our individual purpose. Everything we experience, good and bad, has a meaning, even if we might not understand it right away. It's all happening for us to learn. I tell my own children that God is an energy that stands behind the creation of everything. God is visible in the mountains, the oceans, the sky, the trees, the sunlight, the rain, the animals, and the seasons. Without nature, nothing and no one would exist. Nature is divine and is what keeps us all alive. Today, at age 38, I feel I'm on the cusp of a whole new life, a rebirth of sorts. My goal now is to continue learning and developing my talents in order to use whatever gifts I have to help serve the greater good. I believe many people are preoccupied and distracted by information overload and bad news. And my hope is that this book can serve as an inspiration tool that focuses instead on internal spiritual values. When I was young, I had no way of predicting what would happen to me 20 years later. I was too busy living, too busy making choices. I once read that when we look back on our life, we can see a storyline, or an order, or a plan, as if it were composed by an invisible force, and that the events, and even the people in it, that seemed random or unimportant at the time, become in the end indispensable to our story. Our lives play an important role in the lives of others too. It's as if our lives were cogs in one great dream of a lone dreamer in which all the characters are also dreaming. When we look back, it's as if, without knowing it, we were all co-creating our lives. But how though, and with whom? I know that I'm still relatively young, but looking back on my own life so far, I feel an enormous sense of gratitude. I've been given phenomenal opportunities, and I have worked hard to make the most out of each of them. My life didn't just happen to me. I chose to move to São Paulo when I was 14. Many years later, I chose to marry my husband. I chose to have our children. I could have never left Brazil. I could have played professional volleyball. I was good at it. Or become a veterinarian. I could have married somebody else, or never married, or never had children. The life I live today is an accumulation of dozens of decisions I have made. When I was younger, I took advantage of the doors that swung open for me. But as I've gotten older, I've started to push the doors open for myself. If we make choices more consciously and with greater self-awareness, we will find ourselves more closely aligned to our purpose in life, whatever it might be. Over the years, friends and strangers have confided in me about the struggles of the girls and women in their lives. They have told me that their daughters or friends were facing depression, anxiety, eating disorders, self-harm. And in response, I share some of my own challenging experiences with the hope that they would feel supported and know they were not alone. We are all bombarded today with images of how we should look and how we should behave. And yes, I know that for more than 2 decades, I worked in an industry that can have a tendency to exalt unattainable images of beauty, style, and glamour. I know, too, that social media is about showcasing the best moments of our lives, not the worst ones. On my own Instagram, you won't find a lot of photos of me with a headache or with bags under my eyes from staying up all night with my children when they get sick. Life can be magical. Believing it well takes work, focus, patience, compassion, determination, and discipline. Jealousy or comparing yourself with anyone is a toxic recipe. Jealousy only produces feelings of never being good enough. I believe we are, each of us, singular in our own way. We each have something unique to offer, which only we can give to the world. Many women I know are simply overwhelmed, Whether they are in high school with too many activities in their schedules, or in their 30s and 40s, being run ragged while trying to be a good mom, a perfect wife, a star at work, or all three, they spend almost no time alone. They have lost a connection to nature and to themselves. They are looking for answers outside themselves, not realizing that the answers that matter most are on the inside. There was a time when I was that person. So naturally, I'm also writing this book to my younger self. If someone had shared these lessons with me when I was in my teens and 20s, maybe my own ride would have been a bit easier. And I want to share these lessons with my own children too. I always ask myself, in what way could I help them cope if they weren't my children? Or if I weren't here? How can I leave them something valuable and important? The lessons contained in this book are the ones I most want my own children to learn and remember as guiding lights in their own lives. For 23 years, I was a student in the School of Fashion, and one of the first things I discovered was how shallow it could be. A lot of the time, being a model made me feel torn and guilty. Modeling was never my passion or my identity. It was a work opportunity that appeared when I was very young, and I took it. That isn't to say I'm not extremely grateful for all the opportunities I was given or to the people who offered them. Today, whatever visibility I have is because of my work in fashion. And now, I can use some of the tools I've acquired to bring more attention to projects that are closer to my heart and that I believe can have a positive impact in the world. Most people know me only as an image, an object, a blank canvas on which they can project their own stories or dreams or fantasies, which ironically was the same approach I took at work when I became she and her. For 23 years, I've also been an image without a voice. I have this in common with lots of women. Haven't most of us gotten the message that our voices aren't worth hearing? Whether we are being ignored in a meeting, or criticized online, or reduced to a bunch of body parts? Allowing myself to be open and vulnerable. Not her, but me, Gisele. It's very scary. I won't be able to detach or hide anymore. At the same time, take it from me. Nothing feels stranger than to be the object of someone else's projections. To be known, but also unknown, no longer feels right to me. Life is not always easy, nor is it a fairy tale. And we all go through challenges, no matter who we are. By speaking up, I hope I can inspire other women to do the same, especially at a time when women need to support other women more than ever. After all, changes only come about when we are willing to stand for what we believe. The lessons in this book are not rules. As someone who has always questioned the status quo, I certainly don't want to become anyone's status quo. Some of these lessons might come across as common sense or familiar. My goal is simply to interpret specific beliefs in the context of my own life and experiences. And like most people, I'm still learning as I go and trying to improve every day. If these lessons are useful, great. If one, two, or all eight of them don't resonate with you, let them go and move on. Remember, I grew up questioning anyone or anything that claimed to have the answer. And you might feel the same way. I'm not pretending to be an authority or an expert even for a second. I'm no better or worse than anyone else. These lessons have simply worked for me and helped make my own life better by giving a deeper meaning. Still, if you walk away with just one message from this book, I hope is the importance of living your life with love. Loving yourself, loving other people, loving the world in which we all live. Throw away everything else, but please, please don't ever live your life without love.
Chapter 1. It all starts with discipline. Discipline is a hard word to love, especially when we're young. Can't I put off thinking about that for a few more years? It's a word that sounds like it belongs in the military or a boarding school, or on a list of rules and regulations that keep us from doing what we want to do. Discipline can sometimes seem like the enemy of fun or happiness, a grown-up plot designed to drown out joy and inspiration. It's really not that at all. Discipline is also more than just hard work, but that's where the process starts. Ever since I can remember, I have been extremely organized and hardworking, whether I was helping my sisters clean the house, playing sports, doing well in school, modeling, or even today, being a wife and working mother. Which is why I feel such a strong connection with this first lesson. It all starts with discipline. I believe that whatever success I've achieved in my life is the result of focus, hard work, dedication, being on time, doing what is necessary, what was asked of me, and always giving 100% to everything I did. And I still approach my life this way. In other words, discipline. In our house, discipline mattered. With 6 children, all girls chattering away at the same time, it was a necessity. My mom, for one, was always running around, working as hard as she could to take care of all of us. Every morning at 6 a.m., she woke up and made us breakfast shakes using avocados or bananas or apples that she mixed with milk and a little bit of sugar. Or sometimes she made us tajadas, which are sandwiches with melted cheese inside. Afterward, she or my dad would drop us off at school, and my mom would go to work, coming back home at noontime so we could all eat lunch together. On weekends, she got up even earlier to wash our clothes and to make and freeze meals for the week ahead. With 8 people sharing 3 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms, my sisters and I understood early on that we were expected to help out. Each of us was given a cleaning assignment before we were allowed to go outside and play. When Haki or Fofa rang the bell, it was off to our stations. I was usually in charge of cleaning the bathroom, and often I spent a long time scrubbing between the tiles with a toothbrush until you could have eaten a meal off the floor. To be comfortable, I've always needed my living spaces to be clean and organized. If my surroundings are messy, I can't even think properly. My sisters and I also each served as the unofficial mom for the sister just below us in age. At age 8, I remember changing my sister Fafi's diapers, and then helping my older sisters fry up empanadas in the kitchen that we'd helped our mom make from scratch. Dough folded and sealed over fillings like chicken, beef, or cheese and spinach. "Good girl," my parents used to tell us whenever my sisters and I did something well. When we were polite, when we did what we were asked, when we worked hard, got good grades, or played a good volleyball game. But even when things didn't go according to plan, my mom and dad always made us feel we'd done the best we could if we applied ourselves and worked hard. "Good girl" was a big compliment. It always made me feel proud of the effort I put in. Whether I was scrubbing bathroom tiles, studying hard to do well in school, or playing sports, I always brought an intense focus and motivation to everything I did. At age 10, when I started playing volleyball, I told myself that to get good at it, I needed to practice at least 2 hours a day. I decided I would train as hard as possible to make the team, and maybe the team one grade above mine. The way I approached schoolwork was no different. If I wasn't strong in a subject, I would stay up all night studying if necessary until I got an A. Discipline was never a faraway idea or something I'd grow into later in life. It was always a part of me. Doing my best, making my parents proud, not letting anybody down. If I wanted to succeed at something, I wouldn't just envision what I wanted, or wait for it to show up, or expect someone to hand it to me. I knew I had to do the work to make it happen. Even if I was scared and it felt impossible, I always gave 100% of my effort, because if I gave anything less than my best, I knew I'd get upset with myself. Yet underlying my sense of discipline was the strong feeling that whatever it was I set out to accomplish, I could do it if I worked hard enough. Even when I was afraid, I never felt defeated. I felt challenged. As time went on, I became more disciplined, probably because I could see direct results. At age 14, when I left my hometown and family to move to São Paulo to pursue a career in modeling, I was determined. I told myself, I'm not going to go back home empty-handed. I'm not going to disappoint my parents and my sisters. I'm going to work as hard as I can and do what I have to do, even if that means working all day and all night. Without discipline, I might have taken the next bus home. The work could be intense, and I missed my family. Often I was lonely. But I stayed in São Paulo and kept at it. One opportunity appeared, followed by another and then another. I kept pushing myself. By 1999, after I signed a contract with Victoria's Secret, I was working 350 days a year. During a typical season, just one day included modeling in up to six shows, followed by the fittings for the next day's shows. Hair and makeup could start at 6 a.m., and the fittings at times lasted until dawn. It didn't matter if I got to bed at 2 a.m. the night before. I needed to do fittings. I showed up every morning on time. It really wasn't a very glamorous scene. Only rarely did anyone offer me a glass of water, and some people felt free to be critical to my face. In my teens and 20s, I remember meeting one beautiful model after another. There were so many. I could barely believe it when somehow I was the one who ended up getting hired for many of the jobs. Why? I have to believe that discipline played a big role. I worked very hard, but I also tried to be fun to be around. All jobs are collaborations, and modeling is no different. I was never late, not once. I was 100% committed. One time on a job in Iceland, I was told to stand on a floating fake iceberg in the middle of a glacier, wearing only a string dress. I was freezing and afraid I might slip and fall into the frigid water, and yet I just smiled, doing my best not to show how panicked I felt. I told myself that it didn't matter if I was shivering or if my lips were turning blue. I was going to do the job well. I truly was just happy to be there. I felt so appreciative for every opportunity I was given. Why wouldn't anyone doing what I was doing feel like the luckiest person alive, even when pressed up against a glacier? Plus, I do believe that one reason I became good at modeling is that I wasn't naturally photogenic. There are lots of models who look fantastic on film, but I felt I wouldn't look good just standing in front of the camera. I had to become animated, more like an actress or a dancer, in order to create a special moment. It was important for me to do my job well, but also to never let modeling define who I was. I actually never became a model. I did modeling. Typically, I'd work all day and then go home to cuddle with my dog, Vida, and read. I wasn't interested in parties, glamour, fancy clothes, or late nights. I was happiest going home and starting a new book. These days, when I can, I still do modeling jobs. I love to work. I love being creative, and my work offers me so many opportunities to learn. I love learning and taking advantage of new experiences as part of my nature. But it hasn't always been easy, and it certainly wasn't a straight shot. Today, I take nothing for granted. I never have. I plan to keep working hard and continue to give everything I do 100%. It's the only way I know how to be. I believe if you want to succeed, there are four fundamental steps. Or at least, this has been true for me. Clarity comes first. Everything in life starts with a dream. But first, the dream needs to be clearly defined, and more important, you need to understand why you want it. At 14 and at 20 and at 27, I never said to myself, my goal is to be a great model. Rather, my emphasis was to be the best at what I do, which means giving my best. Honestly, I could have been in any number of professions. Still, whatever I ended up doing, I knew I would have to be the best at it. Not the best compared with others, but the best version of myself. In my experience, clearly defining what you want gives you direction and the inner fire that can motivate you. Maybe you're a B student who wants to get A's. Or maybe you want to be good at sports, a terrific wife and mother, successful at your job, a great human being. Maybe you want to work out regularly or meditate every day. Then be very clear with yourself up front. How will reaching your goals serve a larger purpose? Why does it matter to you? What are you willing to do to come closer to achieving your goals? What do you need to get there? It's also important to set reasonable expectations. I know from personal experience the danger of setting the bar too high, and if you do, how easy it is when you come up short to start criticizing yourself or feeling like a failure, when the truth is that you weren't being realistic. Once you're clear about what you want to achieve, next is focus. Taking the many small actions to propel yourself forward. This is where the hard work part comes in. What will it take for you to reach that goal? Do you need to change your daily routine, or eliminate certain behaviors, or even some people from your life? If you're a B student who wants to get all A's, it might mean that you start getting up an hour earlier to study, or ask for extra help from your teacher, or form a study group. You might also look for a mentor or role model who can show you the way. The third step is dedication. This means staying on track over the long haul and giving yourself credit for what you've done well, but also concentrating on those areas where you need improvement. How are you practicing? How are you measuring your own progress? Are you focusing on what you already do well? Or are you also stretching yourself by targeting the things you may be less good at and then trying some problem solving? In my experience, hard work and dedication aren't the same thing. Dedication includes a commitment to a specific goal or ideal. A lot of people work incredibly hard, but some don't stick with the steps needed to achieve what it is they really want. You may set a number of goals for yourself, but without dedication, they won't become realized. Who has a better chance of becoming a successful musician? The pianist who practices an hour a day, or the one who practices 4 hours a day? Dedication means putting in the time towards what you want and love, the areas where you want to achieve excellence. Dedication says, "I'm going to keep on going, no matter what." Without dedication, you're less likely to see the benefits of all your hard work. If focus means saying yes to hard work, dedication means saying no to distraction, to the activities and even the people pulling you in different directions or pushing you to give up. Be honest with yourself. What do you accomplish in a day? Is your time consumed by answering texts and emails? Are you making progress or just getting caught up? I kept putting one foot in front of the next, even when I was teased by my schoolmates, or felt homesick at age 14, or was rejected. I moved forward, one casting after another. Of course, there were times when I missed my parents and sisters terribly, but even though those moments were painful and distracting, they were only temporary visitors. They came and they went. At the same time, I needed to show myself that I could do what I set out to accomplish. The fourth step, humility, is especially important to me. If you're clear, focused, and dedicated, and you end up succeeding at what you set out to do, you might believe you deserve special treatment. Well, you don't. Most people don't have an easy road to the top of any profession. We all face challenges along the way that force us to grow and learn. I know I am no exception. When any level of success is reached, that's the time to reflect on all your challenges. Yes, you may be unusual. Your skills and talents may make you stand out. You may work, as I do, in a public profession. Good for you. But to my mind, the moment you start thinking you're better than anyone else, your achievements don't matter very much. You fall to the bottom rung of the ladder. But if you have humility, you achieve something more important than worldly success. You become a lifelong learner. Humility allows you to grow from your mistakes, to know that everyone and every experience can teach you something. In my experience, it opens the doors to a bigger, more meaningful life. At the end of the day, how different are we from one another? We're all students in the school of life on this earth. Our campus is a tiny blue dot floating in space. And who are we really in the face of all this immensity? In 2015, I took a step back from modeling, but that doesn't mean I stopped working. Today, in fact, I work almost as much as I always have, minus a lot of the traveling. The same discipline that has served me my whole life, I now apply to being the best wife and mother I can be. My relationship to discipline has helped me create a daily routine, and yet I am constantly adapting it to fit the ever-changing details of my life. Structure always helps me stay on track, especially now that I have small children. There are so many interruptions and unexpected events that would throw me if I didn't have a basic structure. I recognize that I'm lucky, because I have a support staff, and most people don't have the day-to-day help that I get. But I still have a long list of details and activities that can't be delegated and demand my full attention. After my second child was born, I realized I needed to craft a completely different kind of daily routine. My goal was to create time for every person and activity that was important to me. There are only 24 hours in a day. So I asked myself, what should a schedule look like that would allow enough time for me, my husband, my children, and the many projects I wanted to do in the world? In order to supply the love and attention I need to give my children, my husband, my sisters, my friends, and even my dogs, I need to focus on my needs first. As a wife and a mom, I am the person in our house who sets the emotional tone of our family. If I'm not feeling good, or if I'm stressed out, or feeling unhappy, my whole family will be affected. I wake up every morning anywhere between 5 a.m. and 6 a.m. to the ocean sound on my phone, which sits on my bedside table in airplane mode. It's a soothing way to begin my day. The sound of the water and the breaking waves fills me with a deep sense of peace. Also, I don't leap out of bed unless the kids wake me up before the water sounds begin. Instead, I like to relax into the process of waking up, as if I'm tiptoeing into warm water. I stretch a little, take a few long, deep breaths, followed by a few minutes of appreciation for my life, my husband, my children, and my cozy bed. Tom gets up early, too, especially during football season, when most mornings he's already left the house for the stadium by 6 a.m. The first thing I do in the morning is fetch a bottle of coconut oil from the bathroom so I can do oil pulling. It's the ancient Ayurvedic technique of swishing oil in your mouth to clean out all the guck and to detoxify teeth and gums. It's supposed to be good for your overall gut health, too. I put 1 teaspoon of oil in my mouth and swish it around for 10 or 15 minutes. You can use many different kinds of oil, sesame, olive, sunflower, but I use organic coconut oil because I like the flavor. I continue oil pulling as I'm getting dressed, and I'm still swishing as I head downstairs to let the dogs out. Then I spit. After letting the dogs back in, I meditate. I light a candle, get into lotus position, and close my eyes. It doesn't really matter if you cross your legs. What matters is sitting tall with your spine straight so energy can flow. Before having children, I would go on retreats where I would sit in silence for a weekend or longer. Now, as I mentioned, because of my busy life, I meditate every morning, usually for just 5 minutes. This practice helps to support my inner balance for the rest of the day. I've been meditating since 2003, so I can quickly get to a deep state of awareness. Sometimes I meditate to figure out the answer to a question, or because I'm confused about an experience and need insight. For example, if I have an emotional knot in my stomach, or a cloudy mind that won't go away, meditation will help me understand why, and also what I need to do to find relief. Other times, my goal is just to find peace or inner calm. Sometimes I switch things up. When Tom is home during the off-season, now and again I meditate in my own bed in the morning, and then again before a business meeting, as it helps my mind to be clear and focused. If Tom and I are on vacation and the kids are with their babysitter, I'll meditate longer. Creating the space and time for meditation has provided me answers. Some people might see meditation as a waste of time. I see it as an exercise in focus and clarity. As a result, I am actually saving time. Today, I do my best to bring the positive energy I feel during my meditation practice into my everyday life, to be present and aware of each moment and passing thought. This can happen while I'm working out, taking a walk, or eating a meal. Some days are better than others, but the idea is to keep on practicing, knowing that it will get easier. My preference is to do my workout soon after waking up, since my day gets busier as it goes. If I'm working out at home, I put on my Bluetooth earphones and go on the elliptical while listening to a book on tape, or sometimes I'll listen to the audio of a YouTube video on a subject that fascinates me, say a series about ancient Egypt or Greece. If I've dropped the kids off at school, Benny is now 8 and Vivi is 5, sometimes I'll drive to the TB12 Sports Therapy Center in Foxborough, about half an hour south of our home in Boston, so I can do rehab for my shoulders and knee. I have dislocated my shoulders a number of times, and last year I tore my ACL while skiing. As with every aspect in life, my morning routine doesn't always go as planned. Some days I'm completely exhausted. I don't want to get up early to meditate and work out because I got to bed too late, or because one of my kids had a nightmare or a fever and slept beside me all night. Sometimes Tom won't get home from away games until 1 a.m., and an hour later the kids pile onto our bed. Tom's games can be emotionally draining. I'm sitting in the stands watching 300-pound guys crash into the man I love, and it's not a movie. It's the reality of my husband's life. That's why I must stay flexible, and some mornings I tell myself, okay, you're not going to meditate first thing. You can meditate after lunch. Meditation is a tool. It's there to support me in being my best, not to trap me or punish me. And on some mornings, sleeping an extra half hour is the best thing I can do for myself. On other days, when Benny and Vivi are up very early, I just take a few minutes with them to gaze outside at the sun rising up over the hills. We all love sun gazing. After meditating and working out, I drink a glass of lukewarm water, about 8 ounces, with half a slice of lemon squeezed into it. It helps flush out the digestive system. As I sip my lemon water, I'm busy making my children's breakfasts and school lunches. I believe strongly in the old saying, "Let food be thy medicine," and I take nutrition seriously. For lunch, I'll pack Benny and Vivi hummus or lentil soup or leftover rice and beans. I'll add diced cucumber, avocado, or chickpeas to the rice to liven it up. Or some days I'll make burritos, Benny's favorite, with a few sprinkles of cheese on top. Then I fill up the kids' water bottles, along with a few drops of my husband's electrolytes. I always try to create as little trash or waste as possible, especially in the form of plastic bottles and bags. My goal is to live as lightly as possible, and I never throw anything away as long as it can have another use. I will compost it, reuse it, or recycle it. Breakfast is often hectic, with kids chattering, dogs roaming, and a tight schedule. I often make Benny and Vivi gluten-free toast with almond butter and honey, or eggs with sliced avocado, or a bowl of cut-up apples and berries with coconut yogurt. Before breakfast, Benny and Vivi do their chores. Benny feeds the dogs. I'm the one who puts the food in the bowls, otherwise Benny would feel sorry for them and give them too much. And then he and Vivi set the table. After breakfast, the kids put their dishes in the sink. If there's time, Benny goes off and plays with his Legos, and Vivi plays with her toy ponies, or sometimes they like playing chase around the house, especially when their brother Jack is with them. I finish cleaning up the kitchen counter, since I like leaving rooms as tidy as I found them. Plus, as I said before, I can't think straight if I'm in a messy environment. Then I eat my own breakfast. Often I finish off my kids' leftovers, or drink a glass of green juice with celery, cucumbers, half a red or green apple, turmeric, ginger, lemon juice, and sometimes kale or beets. Or I have avocado toast. Benny and Vivi pick up their backpacks, zip their jackets, and put on their shoes. Then we're off. The car ride to school is one of my favorite times of the day. It's just the three of us, Benny and Vivi in the back seat, and me behind the wheel. We love singing in the car, though Benny takes his singing very seriously and doesn't like it when Vivi sings at the same time, so if he's singing, she plays the part of DJ. On the drive back, I listen to a podcast or an audio tape, or sometimes an astrology report. If I wasn't able to do my workout earlier, I do it when I get back from taking the kids to school. Afterward, I take a quick shower, and now I'm truly ready to start my day. I usually don't wear makeup if I'm working from home. But if I go out, I like to wear at least some lip balm, a light mascara, and a little bit of concealer. And in my bag, you will always find concealer and tinted lip balm. Do I sometimes enjoy wearing makeup? Absolutely. It's a fantastic tool. If I look half asleep, or I have circles under my eyes or a pimple on my face, or I want to make my eyes pop, concealer and mascara are best friends. Makeup is fun. It's the only way my eyes will ever look large, or at least not small. Which is why if I'm going to a public event, I always wear makeup. But I don't think about wearing makeup as an obligation. The truth is, I think looking good and having good skin has more to do with what you eat, how you live, and how you feel. Having a good dermatologist can also help. I do think that I look my best when I eat healthy, exercise every day, drink plenty of fluids, and get the rest that my brain and body need. Our insides reflect our outsides, and vice versa. If we maintain a healthy inner environment, it will show up in our complexions. And to me, nothing could be more naturally beautiful. But back to my day. After my early morning routine, I feel energized, my mind is clear, and I'm ready to sit at my laptop and focus 100% on being productive. I keep a separate space a short distance across the lawn from our house. I call it the sanctuary. I love it. It's clean and quiet and sparsely decorated, with plants, crystals, high ceilings, and lots of light. I spend most of the day there answering emails and phone calls and having meetings. Often in the mornings, I am in close contact with my twin sister, Pachi, and Fafi, discussing business, evaluating new opportunities, approving material for clients, answering interview questions, or working on environmental projects. Today, most of the companies I work with are in Brazil, and I consistently express my concerns about our environment and the need to create products and practices that are sustainable for the Earth. Some companies are definitely more conscious of sustainability than others and are making changes to clean up their supply chains. I hope in the future that caring for our environment will become a priority for companies across all industries. Although I've been working in my industry for a long time, it wasn't until recently that I learned that the fashion industry, especially fast fashion, is one of the biggest polluters on the earth, and that most clothes end up in landfills. I am now using my voice and contacts to bring attention to this problem, and to develop solutions to make the business of fashion more sustainable. For almost 10 years, I've also been working as a goodwill ambassador for the United Nations Environmental Program in order to help draw attention to environmental issues. This opportunity has been a tremendous learning experience. I've traveled abroad and met so many inspiring people from different parts of the world who are developing innovative solutions to the problems in their communities. I love learning and sharing experiences and knowledge with the wide variety of people I meet. I connect with experts and like-minded people who have the same desire to do their part to make the world a better place, like my friends and colleagues at Believe Earth, the project that some friends in Brazil and I started to bring more awareness to the preservation of our planet. Part of our mission is to share inspiring stories of ordinary people who are making a difference in the lives of their communities as a way to inspire more people to work for the greater good. My days are extremely full and never quite long enough. I really wish each day could be 48 hours long. I often have a number of different projects going at once. During the day, I keep the ringer of my cell phone turned off. Of course, I check it regularly to see if Tom or someone from my kid's school has called. But in general, anyone who knows me knows I dislike talking on the phone. I prefer seeing people up close, face to face. When I'm traveling, I FaceTime Tom and the kids every day. But when I'm at home, I refuse to be a slave to my phone. During meals, a big rule in our family is no gadgets at the table. I leave the sanctuary and head back to the house in the middle of the day for lunch, usually a fresh salad or a big bowl of soup. Lunch is also when I get a handle on whatever issues may have come up that morning with the children, babysitters, house stuff, and so forth. An hour later, I'm back in the sanctuary, where I work until late afternoon.